everybody. I'm Pete. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank the group and John for this kind invitation to me to be here with you tonight to share my experience and hope. Living and experiencing what it's like in the sunlight of the Spirit. I can tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now in a general way. Living life on self-will, experiencing this power, and living according to God's will. But what happens when we're around here a little bit and we're practicing these principles and we need to go past that? We need to go past the methodology. We need to go past the inventory and amends that we're doing. We need to go from a place where we currently are to a new place, a place of knowing to a place called unknown. And living with that, our book talks about that vital sixth sense. What's that all about? What's it like carrying a vision of God's will into all my activities? What's it like living with something called an experience in emotional sobriety? Because my experience has proven to me over and over again that there's a lot more to this than meeting tonight at a meeting or getting to our local home group and talking to the sponsor. And there's a lot more to this than our big book. There's a lot more to this than our meeting book. Because we're talking about the power of God in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so anytime I get an opportunity to share my experience and hope, sure, I'm going to, God willing, qualify for you, let you know I earned my seat here, or I was lucky enough to have a seat here. But what happens when we're around here a little while? Because myself, and I've heard countless others come to meetings, go through the steps, and get attached to methodology, start worshiping the book, start worshiping the methodology rather than the glory of God, and then little by slowly we start to hit a wall and experience some flatlining in Alcoholics Anonymous and wondering what's going on. How come I can't get past where I currently am and I'm working with all the disciplines they're telling me? And what I have found firsthand is the importance, how vital it was for me to continually go through this work over and over and over again. And continually seek new experiences with this power. Even when there was times I felt like going through the work again that nothing was happening, all I was doing was plowing the field and God was going to do the growing and give me experiences as he needed to give them to me. So I'm just so grateful to be on the other side of the archway, going through the work again and experiencing this power. It was about a whole lot of booze when I was out there, and now for me, currently, it's about experiencing a whole lot of the glory of God, because that's what I found this whole deal is about in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come to meetings, we find the program in this fellowship, and then once we wake up because of the experience with the 12 steps, in the form of service, we go work with others. And then we go past that, and we start to experience bliss, we start to experience the power of God, and that is something that we really need to shout from the rooftops about in Alcoholics Anonymous, that this whole thing that we do here is about God. All the work we do, all the fellowshipping we do, all the service we get to do, whether it's one drunk work with another or setting up the meeting like tonight, and we're going to break it down after the meeting, all the stuff we do here, our point is to experience this power of God. Because my life has proven to me in here and out there that the only thing that's going to keep me separated and bring me to a place called bliss is God. And what I got into a handful of years ago was I stopped worshiping God, but I started to worship methodology. I started to worship my book. I started to worship my home group. I started to worship a sponsor. And I started to worship my emotions. If I was feeling good that day, I must be a spiritual giant. And if I wasn't feeling so good that day, maybe I'm doing something wrong. And I started to become a worshiper of my emotions. I became a prey to comfortability around here for a while. I go through the steps and things start to look good and my external world starts to look really good. And I start to use that as a barometer for an internal condition. And little by slowly I start walking into a wall again and away from the sunlight of the Spirit. Because it's been proven to me over and over and over again, the only remedy for an internal condition that I suffer from called alcoholism is experiencing God. And deluded mind will tell me, well, once my external world, once everything out there looks good, I'm going to feel good in here. And I start to worship all of that stuff. I start to worship my external world rather than the power of God, and that's what I would do. I did that many times in Alcoholics Anonymous. thinking I am my job, thinking I am my relationship, thinking I am my home group, thinking I am my money, and getting this false sense of self. And it's all good when everything looks good. And then we remove one of those things from the equation, and we're down on our knees again. You know, when she wants me back, when I have enough money, when the boss loves me and I got the right job and a new car and it's clean just right and I can drive up to the meeting looking really good, I'm a spiritual guru tonight. You with me? When she says don't come around anymore, I'm calling my sponsor help, I need to go through the steps again, right? Why? Because I'm so attached to external conditions. And what happened to me was this, all of it got removed and I didn't ask for it. I've shared this many, many times about going through some stretching and incredible challenges sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything that I thought I was removed from my life. A marriage, a home, a job, and financial security in about 20 minutes. It was completely removed from me. Where was I going to turn to? And I had many, many arguments with God. I showed him the script. I said, here's the script I wrote. God, you forgot to follow it. I thought he was a union guy who was taking a coffee break for about 3 days. And I was a little, you know, disturbed with God. I said, you're not paying attention to my tales of woe here. And going through that stuff, it was incredibly difficult. But this is what I found out. The difficulty, the real difficulty, the suffering, if you will, was because I was still in a place of resistance, that I can still do it my way. Maybe I can maneuver things a little bit better. Maybe I can try harder. And then I got to a place, after doing that a while, to a place called surrender, where the resistance stopped. And I remember it happened in a parking lot, and I says, Father, take me like I am, because I can't do it anymore. With a handful of years in here, I said, I'm done running the show again. Please, whatever you got for me has to be better than what I'm doing. And I went from suffering to surrender, and in that surrender, resistance stopped. And I was out of my mind, away from ego, and finally touching spirit. And there was almost, and if you ever experienced, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There was almost a moment of, it's over. I went from mind to spirit. And I remember telling God these words. And I don't know what was going to happen. I remember at that moment, it was a late night, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen next? I was on the phone with my sponsor the next day, and he gave me a whole bunch of new disciplines to work with, but the approach was different. My approaches to 10 and 11 were different because it went from, I got to do this work, I have to do this work, to I get to do all of this. I get to do my disciplines. I get to pray. I get to meditate. I get to write inventory. I get to make amends. I get to go to a doctor's office. I get to come here tonight. I get to do this stuff. And there was a shift in consciousness, and I didn't even know it. It was just a matter of going from suffering to surrender to no more resistance. And that is the peace when we stop resisting. And I go back to 1988 when God separated me from alcohol, there was no resistance. Our book talks about no reservations of any kind or any lurking notion, no resistance. We know we're done, it's over, please help. And we're willing to go to any lengths when we're off of that, right? We're willing to go to any lengths to recover? Absolutely. It's when ego starts to reemerge and I think I'm running the show and I'm doing a great job, where any lengths is now on my terms, not what the sponsor has told me. That God gave to him with his experiences. Now it's like, well, maybe he needs to go through the work again. I don't need to call him. Those amends I can wait on. I'll write inventory tomorrow. I feel good. She loves me. Got the new car outside the meeting and a pocket full of money. And if you like me, a new cigar. And everything's great. Remove one of those things from the external world and I'm down on my knees again crying. So what I've learned, really, and it was difficult, I can't stress this enough, how difficult, people close to me know how difficult it was for me. My energy level during this time of my life was nil. I mean, I didn't even have it to pick up the phone at times. It was so depleting. And all I had to do was keep turning back to this power, keep turning back to this power. But what I found firsthand is that God, and God only is what's going to keep me electrified, was going to keep me in a place called bliss, was going to keep me separated from alcohol and experience all the wonderful things I experienced and look at the difficulties as challenges, but I'll get through them. God only. And so I've been working with some new disciplines with the 10 and 11. I get to do this stuff. The road has gotten a little bit smoother. It's still rough, trust me. but I'm approaching it different. There's been a shift for me. Prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle is what our book talks about in step four. Prepared to look at my life as it shows up with an entirely different perspective. Because it's perceptions which cause me pain and suffering, not reality. Not reality, perceptions, and that needs to be changed, and God's the only one's going to do it. What I do is I show up to my big book with a pen in hand and a notepad, direction from a sponsor, I'm willing to go. Not knowing what the outcome's going to look like, because trust me, if you're like me, if you knew what any lens looked like before it showed up, you may not agree to the contract, right? But any lens keeps showing up in different places in my life, in different forms, and I get to go through that stuff. And it has made me new. Completely revolutionized my whole concept, for lack of a better word, with this power of God. It's been proven to me over and over and over again that God knows me, Peter Marinelli. And he knows you too, and maybe you just haven't gotten to that place to experience it, that he hears your heart. He reads your soul. He knows all about you. He knows everything we're experiencing. Because for me, it was like, well, I know God's out there now. I've been in AA, I've done some work, I've had some experiences, but there was just a little piece of me that wondered, does God really know me, Peter Marinelli? And how I feel, and when I cry, and when I laugh, and when I'm angry, and when I'm full of fear. Does God know all of that stuff? And over and over and over and over again, it has been proven to me absolutely does. So when some dramas show up, some challenges show up, and I say challenge not to sound politically correct, because they're challenges. I don't want to give into the word called difficulties, because that's a negative spin, and when difficulties show up, I run. When challenges show up, based on my experience, I know one way or the other, my Heavenly Father is going to walk me through. The difference is I know it may not turn out the way I think it ought to. And that's what gives me courage to face some fear. Which is also, let me touch on that for a second, a myth you'll hear in a lot of AA meetings, that fear and faith or fear and God can't be in the same room together. That's a lie. Isn't God everywhere? And trust me, when fear knocks on my door, God better be there. Courage better be there. Faith better be there. Because if it isn't, I'm in serious, serious trouble. Because there's one thing I knew how to do when that stuff showed up is get drunk. And I haven't in almost 17 years. And I face fear many, many times. So little by slowly, the challenges that I got to experience, that we get to experience, and we all do from time to time, knowing this power is walking me through it, and maybe I need to go to a different direction. And I show up with fear. Well, I'm supposed to be going left, and I'm getting moved right. Uh-oh, it's caving in on me. No, it's the greatest thing that can happen to me. My vision, my limited vision, sees to the end of this room, and my God sees way past this room. And so if there's trouble up ahead, he's going to shift me in a different direction. And I'm thinking, why is he doing this to me for? So the best, if that's my bartender bill, I ain't ready. I'm doing a talk. It's God. Tell him I'm busy. Boy, I better go to church tomorrow, man. Anyway. Okay. I hope he doesn't have a talk for me to do that tomorrow. I got plans. One of the things I found out of the many experiences I've had is we can be the most intuitive. One of us can be the most gifted person with intuitiveness, the most worldly person, the most eloquent speaker on the planet, the most read person in the world. And it all can do with God. And yet it turns into a grain of sand on the beach when we're talking about the power of God and what he can do. And that was an awakening for me. Many times I'd be, you know, being moved in a different direction, and because of my limited vision, because of my limited experiences, and I've had many, I would think something wrong is going to happen because I'm not going the way I think I ought to be, like my current experiences of a few years ago. And when I found out God is just moving me. If we have children and they're running out in the street, we pull them back in. What do? They cry and they kick and scream because they think you're doing something wrong. And when they get older, they realize the love you were giving them and steering them in a different direction. And if I think I'm bigger than a child in the eyes of God, I'm really mistaken. So I listen. and I pay attention, and I work with words like turn, watch, aware, observe. Watch what's going on around me. Pay attention to the silence between the words someone speaks. Silence has, for me, has been one of the greatest experiences I've had in the last year and a half with my disciplines. Silence. I actually love going into silence. I love experiencing silence. And I can do it in a room full of people who are talking. I can do it while my girlfriend's watching television. I can do it at a little league ball game. And I can certainly do it when I hit my meditation mat in the morning, in the afternoon, and the evening. Silence. Experience God is the best words I can offer you tonight, I think, is experience God. I'm no longer a seeker of belief or faith, seeker of experience. Experience this power. Experience this power. That's where we get catapulted. That's where we get rocketed. When we're in that experience, you don't even need words. You can just walk into a room and we know something's going on with you, and it's good. Experience this power. Because then, when you get to a podium or you sit down with another alcoholic, you don't have to quote. You don't have to remember. You just come from experience and in its abundance. The neat thing is, I would think I was going to run out of experience, that God gave me enough and now, you know, I'm on my own. But he's constantly creating. A book talks about recreating our life. I go to an ocean with a thimble. I'm coming home with a thimble full of water. And my Heavenly Father is giving in abundance, just constantly giving. And I go to it. I go to it. And I come away and give away. Great stuff. So much more that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous than just getting to an AA meeting. And if that is your methodology, if that is your prescription, my Lord, you're selling yourself so short. Because some contemporary AA meetings will tell you just put the plug in the jug. As if that's the beginning and end of all of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet here. This is the training ground. This is where we get our tools. This is where we talk about things. We get a sponsor here. And then we go from here out there. And we're packing to the mainstream and do great things with our lives. People become entrepreneurs, become very wealthy people. We do great things. We do great things, become wealthy people by becoming family members again. Because that may be the lottery for some of us. That may be the wealth we experience by being a mother and a father to our children or a son to our parents. Just being part of a family again and giving rather than taking away. That's been it for me. My family was kind enough to let me back in, and that has been my great lottery hit in Alcoholics Anonymous, other than sobriety, is about being part of my family again, being part of involved with my life with my dad and my kid brothers, being able to have relationships with women, relationships, not relations, big difference, what a good deal. And on most nights, I sleep because of practicing these principles. So you want me to get to a podium. You want another alcoholic to get to a podium or an alcoholic who walks in the door and tell them all you have to do is not drink and go to meeting. And we leave out a carload of experiences to that new person. We shortchange, I hear it all the time, we shortchange Alcoholics Anonymous. We do an injustice to the power of God. We do an injustice to our humble legacy that preceded us in here because there's so much more to this. Some of the greatest spiritual teachers that have been in my life have been members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I study a lot of people outside of here, but some of the greatest teachers in my life, spiritual giants, were alcoholics, members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go figure. And they're constantly seeking new experiences. It wasn't that way when I showed up in 1988, when God in His infinite mercy separated me June 23rd, 1988 from alcohol. I thought and I just wished to die at the hands of a bottle because that was the easy way to go. I had no plans of walking into Alcoholics Anonymous, waking up, becoming a recovered member, and working with others and passing this message on and doing some of the wonderful things I get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous and facing life on God's terms, no more on life's terms. Who knew about that when I was separated in 1988? It came after about, I don't know, 15, 16 years of drinking. My first drink at 14 lands me in a hallway 15 years later, dying of alcoholism and begging to die. Who would have thought that? My first drunk, I was 14. It was a great drunk. It worked. It did great things for me, drinking Colt 45 beer. Over in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, John knows the neighborhood. I think we both owe the same people money, if I'm right. there I was, 14 years old, you know, rebel without a clue, and my friends are drinking Colt 45 beer, and I want what they got. They were older guys. They were 16 and 17, and they were roughhousing and talking to the girls and doing all the great things you do when you have your innocent drunk and everything is, it looks great, right? The perception. And so I remember taking a few pops off that court and nothing happening to me. And after I drank a few more, and I drank a little bit more and drank some more, something happened to me that really changed my life forever. Indescribably wonderful is what I experienced. And I got to a place out there that was incredible because little by slowly, as Colt 45 beer started to do its deal on me, fear started to be removed from me also. The fear of my dad, the fear of the cops, the fear of who I was, and I didn't like who I was. I felt like a loser from Jump Street. Right from the beginning, I felt like an absolute loser. I can never talk to women. I can never hang out with the guys and just, you know, kind of be part of the crowd. But when I was drinking Colt 45 beer on a Saturday night, little by slowly, fear was removed. The thinking mind got still for a little while. And I was part of life at last. Bill says in his story three great words, I had arrived. And when I was drinking Colt 45 beer, I had arrived. As I continued to drink, I got taller and bigger, hair on my chest, some muscles probably. I think I had tattoos by the end of the night. But it was a good deal for me. Alcohol worked on my alcoholism for many years. It was not a problem. It was a solution to my bedevilments. It worked. It was not a problem, and I return to my source many, many times because it was going to work for me. I go back to my alcohol because it was going to take me out there, and I knew it was going to take me out there, and I kept going back over and over and over again. The first time I got drunk, I didn't get into any kind of trouble either. I went home. I went to bed. I got up the next morning. No black eyes, no soiled clothes, no cops looking for me. No one was looking for me. And I went down to the park the next day to play some basketball with the older guys. But I remember walking into the park with a little different posture. My shoulders felt a little bit wider. I got some stripes the night before. And now I can measure up to the older guys who were talking about their night and their drunk. And I can do that now. I can get in there and mix it up with them. What a good deal. And I kept thinking, man, next Saturday, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to get in there with the guys and get fired up and get to that place out there that's indescribably wonderful and bring it on because I'm ready to roll. I couldn't wait. The fear of losing my mom, who took her life about 6 months prior to my first drunk, which crippled me. It took my legs out from under me. I was completely devastated by it. I watched her suffer from alcoholism and then die. Take her life. That pain, that incredible pain was removed. The fear of my dad removed. The fear, period, removed. So give me some more Colt 45 beer. And when Saturday rolled around, I drank. I got somewhere out there, and I chased that for a long time. It just wasn't the same. It just wasn't the same as the first one. And little by slowly, what I started to experience was some consequences because of my drinking. I mean, I would get into trouble like most kids, but I wasn't drinking yet. Did I still experience alcoholism? Absolutely. My big book is clear on that. I go back to my life, not back to the first drink. So that stuff was brewing. And I would get into some trouble. But once I started drinking, I was in trouble a lot because of the drinking. Over and over and over again. And they would be little things like, you know, me coming home past curfew. Me getting into a little bit of trouble, maybe some fights. And then it started to get worse because my alcoholism started to own me. And so I would get up like Bill talks about in his story when the morning terror and madness were on him. It was on me already. And I was just out of the starting gate. And what I needed very often was money. And I usually didn't have any, which meant I had to go take yours. And so I had a loving dad home and two terrific kid brothers. And so what I would do is take from them. And I would justify it if there was 50 you know, bucks in a drawer, 30 sounds like half, so it'll go with me. And I started to take things that didn't belong to me, and I woke up one morning needing some money, and I couldn't find anything. I discovered my dad's checkbook, and I got the brainstorm if I forge his name on the check, I can go down to the bodega, the liquor store, and cash him and get fired up, and I did that. And I was doing that a few times I did that. And I didn't know anything about checking statements. I was young. He got that stuff back in the mail, and then he came looking for me. And my dad's a street guy, tough guy, South Brooklyn kind of guy, and I am not like that. He would walk in the room, and I would look for an exit sign. And when he realized, he put all the pieces of the puzzle together, money missing, this guy's never home, he's always in trouble, and now I get all these forged checks. He put, you know, connected the dots, and he didn't need God to do that. He came looking for me, and he caught me in Lower Manhattan by the Southbridge Towers. And I was sitting in a car with the girl I was dating. he drove up in his car and jumped out of the car. And my dad's presence shows up 20 minutes before he gets there. And he jumped out of the car and screamed my name. And I knew I was in trouble. So I told her, you deal with him. I'm leaving. And I left her in the car there and took off. And he caught me. I remember coming up with a lot of fake tears and blaming her in the car and blaming the guys on the Lower East Side and some of the, I was a wannabe musician, some of the clubs I was hanging out and playing in, and it's their fault. And my dad had done a little bit of research on my problem and didn't buy any of it, thank the good Lord, and they sent me off to my first treatment center. And I was in this treatment center for 28 days. Now, book is really clear. It says we have to concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholics, the first step in recovery. I had not made any kind of concession at all. In fact, my dad caught me. I cried, not to get in more trouble than I already was in. And when he told me you're going to treatment, I said, okay, fine. I'll get off the streets and get away from him for a little bit. I had not conceded to my innermost self that I was a real alcoholic. The only idea I had about an alcoholic, I didn't even think my mom was an alcoholic yet, was what I saw as a kid growing up. And those were the guys, the old men on the Bowery with raincoats, or guys sleeping in the streets in cardboard boxes. I'm certainly not one of those people. So I do 28 days in this treatment center, and I did a lot of push-ups and sit-ups. I ate great. I was sleeping great. I really wasn't feeling too much of the torment of detoxing yet. And I had a girlfriend meet me at the door, and I inquired about some AA meetings. And 28 days later, she picked me up, and I picked up a drink, and I was right back to that same vicious cycle. And that's how it went pretty much. My family, though, was now looking at me a little bit different. Because they wondered, like, where did they go wrong immediately? My dad was thinking, well, maybe as a kid growing up, I saw my mom suffer too much. That was the reason he's different from his brothers. He was thinking maybe he did too much. Maybe he hollered too much. Maybe he could have brought me up differently. And my family was immediately, down to my grandparents and my uncles and my kid brothers, were thinking that they caused me to be an alcoholic. Yet you'll go to some meetings and a speaker will tell you, I come from my family's enablers, a dysfunctional family, and all this other nonsense. True or not, the family's not here to give their explanation of it, but we'll cop to that many times that it's their fault that I'm here. Some of our families are dysfunctional. Some of our families, you want to call them enablers, so be it. But I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have an experience with this power of God where I can take this and go back there and fix some of the damage that's going on there rather than just cop to that at a meeting saying that's why I'm here. So I'm really grateful for wonderful sponsorship that eliminated that right away. I was on the street a short time, and I wound up making my second rehab, and I hit my third treatment center, and I hit my fourth treatment center. And somewhere in there, I got a job as a longshoreman on the Brooklyn waterfront working with my dad, who had this, like, impeccable reputation. From the time I can remember, he was always, like, some sort of shop steward or foreman. And just a really good reputation. And then I went to work for him. And little by slowly, that started to change. Because I would take my alcoholism into my place of work and show up drunk, leave drunk, get paid and not come back for a couple of days. I learned of a lot of illegal activities on how to make money down there. And I hung out with some people that I shouldn't be in the same neighborhood with and borrow money from them. And they wanted so much back all the time. And I was getting in trouble quickly and a lot. And my dad would have to bail me out of jackpot after jackpot after jackpot. And what he started to experience more of was that terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And he didn't do anything. I was not coming home. I was basically, wherever a roof over my head was, that's where I crash out for the night. And I was getting into some serious trouble. The guys I worked with were, kind of a rough crowd, not the most spiritual people in the world. I mean, they were fed up with the day at sunrise, and there I was. And, I got away with some of my nonsense, but it all caught up with me, too. And I remember getting asked to leave the waterfront. They threw me off the pier and they said, don't come back anymore. And this was a job that was really impossible to lose, and they threw me off the waterfront. And I went to live with, whatever girlfriend would take me in. And I didn't mind too much when I was drinking because they always look like Bo Derek. And then I wake up in the morning and they look like Bo Diddley. And I wonder, I did it again. I remember my dad showing up many times like the cavalry and being sent off to my fifth treatment center. And I was in my fifth rehab for about 9 weeks. I spent 9 weeks in this treatment center separated from alcohol. I was out on a Saturday and drunk on Monday. And my family thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for me. They were wondering, what does it take? What does it take for you? I had lived with my grandparents for a short time, and I came home once after about a two-day drunk, and I came in soiled, looking like the street I just left. And I was literally running through the streets all hours of the night. I was not a pretty drunk. I wasn't a fancy barroom guy. I was in the back of a hallway, in the gutter, in the street, just an ugly scene. And I came home after about 2 or 3 day drunk to my grandparents' house on a Sunday morning, banging on the door, and my grandmother had to ask me to leave and not come home anymore. And I remember when she told me that, how angry I was with her, but I realized being in here that she said it with a broken heart. The same way my dad had to close the door on me and say, don't come here anymore. He was in a place where alcoholism brought him to, was in a place of willing to sacrifice me to save my kid brothers, because that's how bad it got at home. Thank the good Lord he never gave up on me, because if he did, you may have a different speaker here tonight. Because it was the courage, strength, and direction that God gave him and my family that saved me to get into here and be given the life I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I remember my grandparents bouncing me out and my dad locking the doors and having to live on the streets and do a lot of earthy, ugly kind of things for the price of a drink. What alcoholism would do is, again, shift in perceptions, was not even at times allow me to see the consequences of my behavior. They were completely blotted out. Sometimes the consequences of what I was doing may enter, vaguely, but I knew I needed to do this. I needed to go hustle up some money to get money to get drunk. I knew that because I would get sick, violently ill, if I didn't drink. And so what? I'll do what I have to do. And many times the consequences, as I said, weren't even part of the picture. You just go, automatic pilot. And the insanity of my life, not the insanity of the first drink because I was in the allergy, but the insanity of my life became the only reality I knew. This is what you do. This is how it is on the streets. No morals, no dignity, no self-respect, no respect for others. Everyone came with a price tag. And I'll do whatever I have to do, maneuver you the best I can to get what I want. And the bottom line was pour more alcohol into me, because if I don't, I know what's going to happen. And the fear of going without alcohol was terrifying, was awful, because I knew not only how sick I would get, but what I would turn into. Needed to drink. I got addicted to some other things while I was on the street also, which was not a pretty picture either. There were many, many nights in the throes, in the grips of the grapes, that my contact with a God was a few choice words, why are you doing this to me? I just wish I could die. I was laid up in this one of these flea bag motels, and I was kind of in a relationship with this woman. And she worked downstairs in the bar, and there was the motel upstairs. You got the idea what kind of place this was. And that's where I was. And I remember one day, the courage to do battle, as Bill says in the story, was not there. I couldn't take living like this anymore. I was pouring Jack Daniels into me as much as I can get in, and I was throwing some pills down to get me further away from where I was, and nothing was working. I couldn't even get drunk. I couldn't get sober. It was just torment, and I couldn't do it anymore. And I remember in hysterics going into her purse to take money. I was going to steal from her. And what I found was what was left of a bottle of pills, Valium, and I downed them. And I got back into bed and waited to die because that's what I wanted. And God interrupted my death then, as he did many other times, because he had other plans for me, thank God. But that's where I was brought to. And I remember in that moment thinking what my mom must have experienced. Because for years, I said, she took her life. There had to be a part of her that was weak. You don't just take your life. And it took a long time for me to even say that because I thought I was being disrespectful. But I owned up to it. I said, she had to be weak to take your life. I don't care how bad it is. And I remember when I was eating those pills and getting back into bed and waiting to die because I wanted to die, I thought of her and I said, this has nothing to do with being weak. It's the only way out right now. And that's exactly what alcoholism loves to do. Wants me dead, will settle for me drunk. It wins either way. That's exactly the corner it painted me into, and it was loving every minute of it. It was going to get another one. And it had nothing to do with being weak. It was the only way to go. Isn't that horrible? What alcoholism does. Sometimes I'm around here, you know, we're around here a little bit, and we forget about the real horror stories, including our own, of alcoholism. It kills us. Ego will tell me, everything's beautiful. You don't have to do any of this work. You feel good. It'll never happen to you. You'll never pick up a drink again. How bad is it out there? I'll give it lip service. But do I really touch my first step and what it was like being in here? Thank the good Lord I've never forgotten that stuff because my mind will conveniently forget at any opportunity. But it's way down in here. I remember eating those pills and what it was like and how much I wanted to die. It was to get worse. I got bounced out of this place. I was back on the streets, and I remember being in my sixth rehab. And I lasted about a day and a half in my sixth treatment center. And I signed myself out AMA because I couldn't take being in these. The walls were closing in on me. I could not take the confinement. The obsession to have another drink was overpowering. If there was a crack in a wall, it was taking me through. And I, you know, page 24 talks about how we can forget the pain of yesterday. I'm paraphrasing, but we can't bring into my mind the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. My mind was not thinking about the suffering and humiliation of a few days ago. It was telling me, we need to drink and everything will be okay, and I was going with it. Even currently, how many times we listen to our mind and think it's all true? Everything my mind tells my mind, it's got to be true, right? Think about it. How often does it lie to us? Usually does. The thinking mind is a wonderful thing to lose. There's that commercial, the mind is a terrible thing to waste for a very worthy cause. My experience as a recovered alcoholic, it's a great thing to lose. Detach from it. I am not my mind. But back then, I thought everything my mind told me was true. So it was telling me, we're going to go drink, we'll feel a little bit better, and then everything will get good again. Okay, that's true. My mind's telling me, I'm thinking, okay, fine. That's why, how in God's name can we tell an alcoholic, especially a new one, to think the drink through? How many times have we heard that? Play the tape to the end. We're asking an alcoholic with a sick mind to use that sick mind to get better. We might as well just give him a suicide mission. It's the same thing. Rather than telling him, you need to experience God now. You're separated now is fine. You don't need a year or more or to get a sponsor with a year or more. You don't need to be separated here for 30 days or 90 days. You're separated now. Let's go. Someone told me you start the steps when you stop throwing up. But we want the new person to use their thinking mind to overcome a sick mind. Maybe we should, who say that, should go through the work and really reevaluate the information we're giving out to a new person or someone who's around here going through their dramas. But back then, my mind spoke to me, and I went with it. And I signed myself out of the sixth treatment center, and I went right back to, you know what, living hell again. Humiliation, degradation, over and over and over again, thinking tomorrow will get a little bit better. And then I said, you know what, I just wish I would die again. I wound up outside the Port Authority, and by this time I had lost contact with my family. I was unemployable, and I was living for the next drink. And I was outside the Port Authority. I just drove by this spot the other night. I was in Manhattan to have dinner with some friends, and on the way back to get to the Lincoln Tunnel, you go right underneath, like, it's like 41st, 40th Street. I was outside the Port Authority on the 9th Avenue side of the Port Authority, the overhead, where the buses run. And I found myself outside, right underneath that overhead. And I don't know how I got there. I must have come out of a blackout, and I don't know what happened to me afterwards. It was really interesting driving by there the other night. Because I was sharing with someone, this is the spot I always refer to. And I realized at that moment that I was a completely new person because of God. Completely new person because of God. Because a little over 17, well, it was about 17 years ago, I was outside that Port Authority, and I had that moment of clarity. That flimsy reed that where we're struck sober. It's just a little moment, a fleeting moment, but we know at that moment exactly what we are. And in that moment, I knew what I was. That I'm an alcoholic, look at me, and I'm going to die. Look what I've turned into. And I remember in that moment thinking of my mom, who I lost, my dad and my kid brothers, who I hadn't seen for I don't know how long, but it was quite some time, and my life would have turned into. And in that moment of clarity, I knew I was an alcoholic and I was going to die. And what I did with that was curse God. I remember looking up at that overhead, cursing at God with such venom and such anger that you did this to me. You took my mom, you took my dad and my kid brothers, and you turned me into this. What did I ever do to you? And I hated God. One of those guys a book talks about, bristle with antagonism. The hair on my neck would go up. I'd go to war with you if you told me God loves you. Because I was in South Brook in a place called Coffee Park, and a lot of Bible beaters would come in and say, God loves you, find God, get God, and your life will turn around. And I wanted to go to war with them. There's a little piece of me that would say, but why are they so peaceful? The difference between here and what those people are doing, here we give instructions on how to experience God if we're really doing this deal, and those people weren't giving me instructions. But there I was outside the Port Authority, cursing God. And he let me go a little bit longer. But he wasn't going to let one of his children die. And it was a short time later, I wound up back in the back of a hallway. And I remember a book talks about the bitter end of accepting spiritual help. And I was at the bitter end and I knew it. With every fiber of my being, I knew this was it. I had this feeling like if I take one more drink, I'm not going to see another hour from now. I just had this feeling in me that was so real. And there were no bargaining chips, no reservations, no lurking notions, nothing. I was present as I could be to the moment. I was struck awake again. I remember thinking, if you're out there, please take me from this. And I was not thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous or anything to do with this sacred place. Just the first time in my life, and I can't stress this enough, the very first time in my life, I did not want to die. And I look back on my life from the time I was this big, I just didn't want to see another day. It showed up in different type of behaviors. I did not want to deal with life. I did not want to grow up. And as I hit my teens, life scared the hell out of me, and I did not want to live. And I tried over and over and over again to take myself out of this whole deal. And this was the first time, even with the 6 treatment centers prior to this, this was the first time in a hallway that I did not want to die. I didn't want it. And it took me a few years in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that that was the beginning of a spiritual awakening for me, right in that hallway, without steps, because it was a seed of willingness that was planted. It was a seed of willingness. I says, Father, if you're out there, with a few choice words, take me from this. And at that point, that was the any lens I was already signed on for, in the back of a hallway. I just hadn't gotten into treatment yet. I knew I was an alcoholic. I didn't need willingness when I showed up in here. It was in a hallway. It took me years in here to find that out, to really realize that. And that came through some contemplation. It was in a hallway that willingness began and the experience began. And all it takes is a mustard seed of willingness for you to be enlightened, for you to be awake. And by the way, enlightened, we'll hear a lot of that word often, enlightened. It's just oneness with God. You don't need to shave your head and go live on a mountain. You don't need to live in a monastery. If you do, great. It's just oneness with this power, experiencing this power. That's enlightenment. And then we get to live present and now, mindful of the breath, here, now, present. That's enlightenment. Ain't that so much more than getting to a home group every night? Or getting to a meeting every night? And putting on a pot of coffee? Imagine if we said that's all there is about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll talk about being enlightened people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what happened to me after that moment outside the Port Authority, but it was a short time later I made a prayer to this God in the back of a hallway, and my dad showed up like the cavalry. I remember going to the phone one day 3 times. I remember thinking in this hallway, I got to be in touch with my dad. He's the only one who on this planet who's going to take me. I burned every bridge. And I remember going to the payphone to call my dad in tears. I was going to call and collect. I had no money. I had soiled clothes. I looked the part of a Bowery bum, like the people I always thought about were alcoholics. Well, I was one. And I would go to another payphone and pick up the phone, and tears would come. I was getting these crying jags all the time. And I thinking, like, how can I even show up to my dad looking the way I do? Look at what I look like, my Lord. And my dad was with his wife in South Jersey gambling. And that day he had a feeling deep in his gut that I was in trouble. And he left Atlantic City and came looking for me. And I remember all day long thinking, I got to get in touch with my dad. It was a prayer. I need to get in touch with my dad. I need to get in touch with my dad. And he gets a feeling that I'm in trouble. And he tells his wife, my son Peter's in trouble. You need to get back to Brooklyn. And God connected the dots and put my dad in my path and put me in his path. And my dad got out of the car this day. And he didn't scream my name. He didn't jump out of the car with the most humble approach looking back on it, because God was moving him. He came across the street, and I told him, Dad, I'm okay. Don't worry about it. I had these soiled clothes and boots with holes in them, construction boots, and I was in some really serious trouble. You know, if I live to be 100, I'll never be as old as the day I walked in here. I mean, it's his best way I can say it. And I remember collapsing in my dad's arms and him holding on to me and telling me I was going to be okay. He wasn't going to lose his son to this. And that is the courage, strength, and direction that God gives all of us. Not only people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because you'll hear God works through people, and my mind would say it's only people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're the chosen ones, right? How arrogant is that? It's people. He just gave us something other than what they have maybe out there to get to him and to save our life. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. And for me, it was my dad. It was the cavalry again, and he showed up out of nowhere, and I went off to, God willing, my seventh and last rehab. And I was in this place about 10 days, and I remember thinking one thing, I got to get out of here and get some Jack Daniels in me or some Mr. Boston Blackberry Brandy. And I can go to group and talk about all the things they're talking about in group, my dysfunctional family, my enablers, my inner child, and you know, all the therapeutic things that are wonderful for some of us. I used to ridicule that stuff a lot. I don't. It works for some, so be it. And I was in this place about 10 days. And I didn't get the opportunity, if you will, to hit the streets. But what they did for me was send me off to Minnesota, where people were just shouting the glory of God from the rooftop, shouting about the experiences they had with the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. They were talking from a language of experience, not just moving their lips and giving, you know, some lip service. And they would invite me into their life, and they'd take me to the diner, invite me into their homes, and I saw how they were talking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and go into their homes, into their lives, into their personal affairs, and saw how they were living, and my eyes could not deny truth. I saw how they were doing the deal. With all their obstacles, they were doing a deal, and I said, I want what they got to offer. How do you do it? And they told me, you tried everything, and the only thing that's going to save you is God, and we got some directions for you. And after about 10 months in Minnesota, I was brought home to my first home group, the Free Spirit Group, and my first appointed teacher showed up. And I worked with this gentleman for about, 13, 14 years. Went through the work, had just wonderful experiences with it. And then there was a shift. I needed more. And I prayed to God to show me a new sponsor. And God connected the dots once again. And a gentleman, Mark H. from Texas, showed up in my life. And when I showed up to him, asking him to take me to be my sponsor, and can you help me? I never forget what he told me. He says, I knew you were coming to me. I've been waiting. He knew me from some workshops. We had some small talk when he would visit New York. And if you don't know who to ask for a sponsor, ask God, because he or she is out there, and God will put you together. And that's what happened to me. And Mark H. gave me he's been just a godsend to me. And I've gone through the work a few times with this man. I'm currently going through the work again, and my family has been reassembled. My life takes on new meaning every day with new challenges, new people that come to me to sponsor them, new places to visit in Alcoholics Anonymous, new relationships. It's absolutely wonderful. That guy I called Dad who saved my life, he and I are on a different footing. And that to me is a miracle. If I had to get one bonus besides being sober, and that was it, I'd settle for that. It's a pretty neat deal when your dad's like your best friend. What you really need is my dad confides in me and we walk together. It was not like that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My two kid brothers were really, really close bond and we lean on each other. That was not like that before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've learned how to have new relationships with new people and suit up and show up as I be. Freedom. That's what I've been given here. Dignity. That's what I've been given here. And the ability to love others without expectations. That's what I've been given here. And with all the fear I've been put in my path, little by slowly, my Heavenly Father puts one foot in front of the other for me many times, like Footprint says, when I think I'm alone, I'm on the other side, and God's carrying me. Let me never, ever forget that. Thank you for listening.